series of six presentations that will cover topics such as environmental sustainability, housing alternatives, creating walkable communities, and innovative retail and third places. The reason this is called the Speaker Series 2010 is that although our comprehensive plan looks forward to the year 2020, excuse me, many of the planning issues we will be hearing about this year focus on a shorter time period. The City Council and Planning Commission are pleased to sponsor these forums as an opportunity for the community to learn more about planning issues that relate directly to the City Council goals for the next 2 years. These planning issues are important in that not only framing how our goals are implemented, but will affect how we chart Shoreline's future. Encouraging strong public participation has been a mainstay value at the City of Shoreline, and informing the community is an important part of that. I hope these presentations will provide you with new frames of references as we work together to implement the city goals over the next few years. Now I'd like to introduce Shoreline's Planning and Development Services Director, Joe Tovar. Joe developed the idea for these series and helped identify topics that would be useful for the community to know more about. He's going to tell us a little more about tonight's speaker, Joe Tovar.
Thank you, Mayor Ransom. I see in the audience with us tonight, we have a couple of the city's elected officials, in addition to the mayor, Councilwoman Janet Way, Councilman Keith McGlashan. Did I miss any other electeds present? We also have members of the city's planning commission. Would you identify yourselves for the crowd so they know who you are? Our planning commissioners are citizen appointees appointed by the council to advise the council on planning issues. A number of city staff people are here as well. Thank you all for coming. This is also being broadcast on the city's television station, and it will be available with streaming video on the city's website for anybody who wants to take another look at this or tell your neighbors about seeing what happened here tonight if they don't happen to be here tonight. Our speaker tonight is Mark Henshaw. Mark is the Director of Urban Design for LMN Architects, a 110-person firm based in Seattle, Washington. For over 25 years, Mark has been responsible for a wide range of projects in large cities, suburban centers, and small towns, including downtown development, public spaces and pedestrian facilities, design-oriented development codes and guidelines, and master plans for public facilities. Mark has served as president of the Washington chapter of the American Planning Association, as well as president of the Seattle chapter of the American Institute of Architects. In addition, he has served on the National Board of Directors of the American Institute of Certified Planners. Mark Henshaw lectures widely nationally on the subjects of urban design at conferences and workshops. He has written a number of professional design journals in landscape architecture, land use planning, and architecture. Several years ago, he also was the architecture and urban design critic for the Seattle Times, writing a number of columns you may have read. Mark also is the author of a planning advisory service report entitled Design Review, which is still the only manual available to local governments in this country on the subject of design review. Mark has also authored two books, one titled City-State Seattle, Shaping a Modern Metropolis, which was published in 1999, and this spring his latest book is coming out titled True Urbanism, Living in and Near the Center. So after Mark makes his presentation, we'll have questions from you all. And after that, we'll turn it back to me, and we'll tell you what's coming up next. So please join me in welcoming Mark Henshaw.
I'm going to use this because I'm going to probably move around a little bit, because I prefer to move than stand behind a podium. Joe mentioned that I was a columnist for the Seattle Times, and I was so for about 12 years until a couple of years ago. But I enjoyed kind of interesting career as a journalist, as well as being an architect and city planner in my day job. But I think I discovered one thing that was kind of interesting when I was in that journalism mode, And that was, I gradually began to get better and better service in restaurants. And I couldn't quite figure this out. And then I sat down and I realized that they ran my headshot next to my name. So people kind of got the name, face, familiarity, but they didn't quite know what I did when I walked in the restaurant. I could hear whispering, you know, writes for the Seattle Times. Well, he might just be the food critic. So there is a benefit, perhaps, to being in journalism. But today I'm going to be talking about another subject, which has actually, oddly enough, benefited from my background in journalism because it allowed me to go around the Pacific Northwest, greater Pacific Northwest, and examine what was happening in communities or what's been happening in communities over the last 15 or 20 years. And it is quite remarkable. We are, I am convinced, now in a new era. It is not the last 50 years, which we are finishing up with, but the next 50 years. And the next 50 years is going to be fundamentally different than the last 50 years. And I'll share with you a few bits of information to substantiate that claim. Next. First of all, the 1990 census started to reveal this, but it was absolutely clear by the 2000 census. And that is that no longer is this country driven by increasing sizes of families. That is no longer our future. Now, we might lament that. We might lament that fact. But it is a fact that we are now driven by four different groups in this country, which already make up more than 50% of the population. They are singles, single-parent households, seniors, and what I call startup families or startup households, four S groups. That is already more than 50% of the population, and it is growing. What people have conceived of as the typical American household, mother, father, children, is less than 25% nationally and in this region, and that percentage is going down year by year. These other percentages are going up year by year. In fact, if you just look at one of those groups, the senior population, and of course it depends on where you draw that line, is it 60, 65, 62, but regardless of where it sort of exactly is defined, it's right now about 17% of the population, about 1 in 6. In another 10 years, it will almost be 22% of the population. More than 1 in 5. That is a huge change alone. Massive change. It will cause us to rethink delivery of goods and services, healthcare, other types of services, institutions, forms of housing, things that we can't even imagine right now. It is very much like the phenomenon that happened in the 50s with elementary schools, in the 60s and 70s with colleges, and in the 80s and 90s with the workplace. It is just rippling right through our culture and will have profound effects on virtually everything that we do. It will reshape our communities. It will be so powerful as a phenomenon, it will reshape our communities in very, very dramatic ways. Now, not over a couple of years, but over 10 or 20 years, we will see this happen because change takes a while to happen. It's not sudden. It's not dramatic. So these graphs indicate number of households going up, size of household going down, continuing to go down. Next. Now, it may seem odd that as an architect I'm showing you charts here, but I'll get to some pictures later. Next thing is this graph, really interesting thing. Our life expectancy has almost doubled in 100 years. Turn back the clock to 1900. People lived till their mid-50s. We've forgotten about that. There was even, probably some of you remember this kind of term, quaint term, it sometimes shows up in novels and literature, dropsy. Does anybody remember that term? It's literally, you dropped dead right where you were. You fell over at the workplace, in your home, on the farm, in the factory. You worked until you died on the spot. We didn't have a concept called retirement. You just worked until you died. Whole idea of retirement is a relatively new phenomenon. Well, now we have people potentially living 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, maybe 30 years after what we consider now to be retirement. I mean, we are going to see people living into their 90s, maybe past 100 very commonly. Huge impact on what our needs will be. A third of our life will, in a sense, be past sort of what we now consider to be retirement. However, I think the whole concept of retirement is going to change. That's going to shift dramatically. That will start to disappear. People will not want to be farmed out, so to speak, warehoused in the Arizona desert. I think most of us will want to be part of real communities, real neighborhoods, real streets, with lots of things close at hand. We will not accept the previous choice that we were given, be put out to pasture, so to speak. We'll still want to be part of vibrant communities. That itself will have another set of interesting impacts. Next. This is already starting to happen. People are not retiring, or they're going into a second career or a third career. They may be retiring from one job, but moving into another type of work. May not be full-time, may just be part-time, but you're already seeing people taking certain types of jobs in later years in life. It's happening in the service industry. People are continuing to work, and there are probably some good reasons for that. Social Security is probably going to disappear. Pension plans, I'm sure you've been reading about that, they're not all that secure. People, even if they have the ability to draw on Social Security and other supplemental forms, it's probably not going to be enough. It's going to be necessary to at least work part-time at something. And a lot of people enjoy that. It feels more productive, it feels more useful, you're active, you're energetic, it's part of health, it's part of natural exercise. So there's a lot of even benefits that it's not necessarily just something you have to do. Work is enjoyable to a lot of people. So we already have figures that show that people are staying in the workplace much, much longer than they have in the past. Next. Actually, wrong direction. Or is that a second one? Okay, go past. Okay, now look at this chart coupled with the last one. A friend of mine that writes for the Washington Post, Neil Pierce, who you might read from time to time, calls this the Longhorn Steer Curve. And there's a whole story about this end of the chart that is probably the subject of another talk, but just look at this end of the chart. And I can assure you that insurance companies are looking at this chart as we speak. And if the state does not take your license away at a certain age, the insurance companies will do so. And we will start to see people not being able to drive. And just happened to my mother a few years ago, where the license is taken away in the mid to late 70s. You just start to lose the eye-hand coordination faculty and other types of acuity, and you just can't be on the road anymore. And for good reason. Tens of thousands of people are dying a year from people that shouldn't be on the road. Also true at this end of the spectrum. And I would have some things to say about that if you wanted to ask me a question later. But this implication is there are going to be many millions of people who will have no access to an automobile. None. Unless you want to depend on friends or relatives or other means of getting around, but there will not be the private car available to this growing population of people that are aging. So what does that mean? That means that if you want to have a good, decent life, you have to look for a place to live where lots of things are within walking distance, or at least transit distance. But I think most people will probably look for places where there are goods and services, healthcare, other things available to them within walking distance, because that's also part of being healthy, of having natural exercise. And there's a whole now set of data from coming out of the health professions that sort of natural forms of exercise are far more healthy than sort of forced forms of exercise. And there's all kinds of literature and statistics coming out on that subject. Next. Now, here's another thing. We've been wringing our hands over this number, and my assistant has to keep changing this up and down. But I think that's not far from what it is today. But what's going to happen when the next slide happens? That's not more than 10 years off. May even be 5. Every time you go to the gas station to fill up, it will cost $150. people are going to think twice about having at least as many cars as they have. It may reduce the number of cars, but it's going to change the type of transportation that people think of, too. This is already giving rise to alternative forms of transportation like flex car. You're familiar with that. I use it all the time. It's amazing. You go to the website, pick out the car you want, anything from a truck to a van to an SUV to a sports car. You get it within 10 minutes and take off, and that's all you need to worry about. No filling up the gas tank. You just subscribe to a condominium car. And that's at least one of the choices that's going to be more prevalent to us in the future, because this will hit people in their pocketbook, hit all of us in our pocketbook. It's going to change people's behavior. Nothing more changes people's behavior than hitting them in the pocketbook. And this is just simply, it's already the case in Europe. In fact, the oil company executives about 3 months ago, you maybe remember seeing this in the paper, had a kind of press conference, and they said, we don't know why Americans think they're immune from oil prices paid by other consumers in the world. Everybody else is paying this. Why do Americans think they shouldn't pay that? And there, you know what that means. They're going to start raising the prices. I mean, they're just playing with this right now, with this up and down thing. That's just a bunch of play, essentially to keep us from looking at alternative fuels, because every time it gets more cost effective to do that, they drop the price again, which means then research starts to go away. So they're just playing a game to work out the last 10 or 20 years of the oil supply, which is finite, is going away. There's no question about that. And simply alternative fuels are not catching up fast enough. We are not there yet. Not there at all. So you can't hope that somebody's going to come up with a miracle fuel to replace petroleum. It's not going to happen, at least in anybody's lifetime here, probably. Next. Well, what does this mean? I mentioned the implication for walking. It means that we have to learn or relearn, because we all know how to do this, walk. And that means thinking about lots and lots of little things that help make that walking experience safer, more attractive, more comfortable, more appealing, more doable. And what we're beginning to do is we work with communities as an architecture firm around the Northwest is look at the walking radius. That's what this circle is, and we applied it to Kent. If you've seen Kent Station, it's a new infill development that's on the edge of their town center. But it's a mixed-use center that's very tight, very walkable. You basically park once, and you walk to everything else. It's not a mall, however. It's not indoors. It is normal streets, normal blocks. This was just one big, huge sort of open field that used to have an industrial use on it. City bought it, flipped it back to the private side with conditions that it develop a certain way, and it has transit connections with the commuter rail system. It has a main street. It has a mix of uses from movie theaters to restaurants to a community college, a whole array of choices for people of all ages. And it has helped sort of reshape and offer whole new opportunities and choices to the people in the community of Kent. And even coming down to certain dimensional things, this was the one community where we actually removed travel lanes, if you can believe that. This used to be a street that had two lanes each direction, and now it has one lane each direction. And that extra space was put back into the sidewalk. The old sidewalk is here, 5 feet wide. This was a town when that was the case, where the common saying in town was, nobody walks here, everybody drives. Well, no wonder. If that's all you have to walk on, who would do that? Now, there's actually as much or more space devoted to people to have this choice. What's happening? People are walking. You don't have to put a sign out that says, y'all walk now. They just do it. They see that now it's a place for people. And kids and elderly people are out there walking every day of the week using the public sidewalks that did not exist before. So just making sure that that kind of comfort zone is available to people to make as a choice as a human being. This is another kind of low tech, and Joe's familiar with this, having been in Kirkland for a number of years. some of these changes don't have to be high cost. They can actually be low cost, low tech solutions. And I don't know if this exists anywhere in your community, but this is a crosswalk, very busy street, one of Kirkland's busiest streets, high volume streets, where instead of a signal, an expensive signal, school guard crossing flags were installed in little cup holders on each side. You take that flag out. Every North American knows what that red flag means. It comes to a stop. It means the traffic comes to a stop right now. You stop right now. And so people hold the flag out in front of them. This particular guy is more confident to do that. But I've seen 8-year-olds and I've seen 80-year-olds pick those flags up, hold it out in front of them, walk across the street, put it in the other cup, and go on their way. The cost of this is probably $10 or $15 a week. And for, you know, you assume some of the flags are probably going to get stolen. But that's a lot less expensive than $200,000 for a signal, because that's what they cost. And so this community, together with another of other communities, have started to go to this almost self-help crosswalk solution. May not work everywhere, probably isn't safe some places, but it certainly could happen in a lot of locations that would just make the day-to-day walking experience safer, more comfortable, easier, and you manage it yourself, if you will. And then, of course, they added in lots of small touches to make sure that that experience, once you're on foot, is a nice one, is a pleasant one. It isn't just a utilitarian set of investments, but a whole set of aesthetic investments that are viewed as adding value to the community. And, of course, then they have mixed-use development and urban housing and other things that are happening within close proximity to each other, as well as public spaces and other things. And I'll get to that in a few minutes. Next. Now, what this means is that we have to start looking at new opportunities and providing new choices. That doesn't mean abandoning necessarily old previous ways of doing it. In fact, we need to make places authentic, which means drawing from history. So we need to go back and look at roots. We need to look at the history of a community, draw from some of those things, make sure that they're there, they're treasured, valued, protected, preserved, enhanced, and so forth. But then add other things that can still reflect a scale and character that's based on sort of human needs, not just suddenly imposing a whole new order on things, but to kind of continue that familiar scale and character. And that's where design-oriented codes and design guidelines come into play to make sure that as new development happens, that it happens in a way that's sensitive, has lots of quality, lots of character. And I can tell you the development community is now getting used to this. It used to be the case that they kind of bucked it. They kind of gritted their teeth and kind of, you know, just reluctantly did this. But I'm beginning to work in communities where actually developers are coming in and asking city council to adopt design standards, asking them to do it, because they want to be assured that if they come in with their good investment, their long-term investment, that a mechanism exists to protect that so that the person across the street or next to them can't throw up a Quonset hut or put up a storage yard. They can be assured, in the sense it's a form of insurance, they can be assured that if they do good long-term thoughtful investment, that the neighbors will be held to the same standard. So it's kind of turned itself on its head. It's gone from the development community resisting this to the development community advocating it. And major development organizations like the Urban Land Institute now have conferences and workshops and traveling seminars that deal with this very subject of how to ensure high level of quality in new development to make sure that it feels good to people that live there. So it really is, and it's also necessary to spend some time nurturing homegrown shops and services. Probably one of the worst tragedies in this country is that we've left sort of let individually owned businesses twist in the wind. We've set up all of their codes and standards and all of their regulations and licensing and insurance and on and on and on to deal with corporations that can afford attorneys and afford accountants and big organizations. And we've scaled everything to that and let just small businesses suffer through all of that same stuff. So we need to sort of figure out how we can get back to sort of the best of the American contribution to the world, which is small-scale entrepreneurial creativity. And we need to figure out at this local level, the state level, the national level, how to reinstill that value back into our communities, because we're losing it. We're just all going to national brands. We're all going to generic products. are all going to could be any place, USA, buildings, and we're losing the distinctive character that makes us want to live in particular places. Presumably people want to live in a place because it's not like every place else. So why would we set in motion mechanisms that make everything the same? I mean, that can't be right. We've got to have standards that speak to the quality and character and history of a community. And that's easy. It's not necessarily easy to do, but it is done. It's legally supportable. There's case law on it. It's perfectly fine to do that. You can decide what you want to see in your community as long as you make it clear, as long as you stick to it. You can't have arbitrary rules. You can't just have a board or committee sort of review and decide on their own. Can't do that. That part's not legal. But as long as you write down what you expect to see, pass it through a legislative process that involves due process and public hearing and all of that, you can have very tight controls if you wish. And I've already seen, just driving around, you certainly have seen a recent generation of buildings that reflect that there has been some care and attention to the form and the quality of new development. Certainly a measurably better set of development projects than were seen probably 10 years ago. And I know this community inherited a lot of sort of bad stuff from the days of the county when the county was here. But now you have it in your own hands and your own capability to guide and direct the future of this place. You're now in control. You don't have to rely on those distant people. Next. Well, what are some of the tools? I mentioned some of these already, the kind of new kinds of codes. What I try to do when I work with the community is to just throw out what they've got already. It's not worth tinkering with, usually. It's leftover from decades past. It's layers upon layers of things. And what I've tried to do is get down to sort of the idea of zero-based budgeting, if you will, where you assume you don't need any of it, and you start over again and rebuild it. And I submit that you'll find if you do that, you've probably only need a fraction of what you thought you did. And so my challenge has been when I work with with communities on their new codes is to see if I can do it in less than a half a dozen pages. And almost always we've managed to get there. Keep it simple, keep it direct, keep it explicit, keep it clear. Don't have page after page after page of things that just stand in the way of creativity and innovation. You've certainly done, I'm sure, a lot of work on your policies and plans. You've sent it in some good directions. You've established a good base. And now perhaps it's time to look at some of these more specific tools, which I'm sure in some ways you're already looking at. I'm not familiar with all of the steps that you've taken. But in addition to the sort of design standards and guidelines that I mentioned earlier, this next one is really a key one, too. And I know that you already are making some of these. But there needs to be a growing, continuing list of things that you do. It's not just doing one or two. You do 4, 5, 7, 9, 12, 15 of these things over a couple of decades. So you never stop making strategic public investments in civic buildings and structures, in community centers, in parks and plazas and open spaces. But they may be of a different type. We are still operating with standards for parks and schools based on the old model of the typical American family. We're still doing that, assuming that that's going to be our future, and it is not our future, so we have to rethink those standards. For example, it's real tough to get school districts to think of anything more than one-story elementary school buildings. Why? There were hundreds of elementary school buildings that were built multi-story for many decades on very small sites. Not huge areas with huge play fields. We need to rethink the idea of the urban school. We need to rethink the idea of the urban market, of the small market, not necessarily the big market. So there's all sorts of things that we need to rethink and recraft. And every profession, I can tell you, every profession, I'm sure you're familiar with, probably your own profession, everybody's rethinking how they do business because of the world is changing. So no institution should be immune from that. They should be rethinking what they're doing, too. It's a new era. It's not business as usual. It's not business in the past. It's a different culture that we're moving into. So we need to look at new techniques and tools. And we need to find partners. It isn't just local government that can do it all. That would be impossible. We don't have all the resources locally in any community to do it all. So we have to have other public sector partners, and certainly done work with the transit authorities.
in the area, but with the schools, with other districts, all sorts of public entities, nonprofits can be a part of that. Even the private sector can be a part of that. Burien, for example, if you've been following that, assembled property in a strategic location for a new sense of a town center that they wanted to see, and acquired the property. There's nothing wrong with doing that. That's perfectly legal under state law. Cities can acquire property all they want, and then they resold it back to the private sector to do a combination of senior housing, city hall, library, town square, retail, and there was something else in there, maybe a transit center. I can't remember. There was some other component. And that's being built. It is underway as we speak. They just started that 5 years ago. So, I mean, you can do this actually fairly quickly if you want to take dramatic action. But it does mean finding a variety of partners to link up with. Next. Retrofitting strip development. This is going to be another big challenge. In some cases, those older forms of development will have reached the end of their life cycle and be torn down. I mean, there's no question about that. At a certain point, it's just more cost effective to tear them down and start over. And you've already seen that a couple of times here recently. But there's also a kind of an interesting thing. If you've seen the development in Woodinville, which is not a traditional shopping center, all of the big boxes there are actually behind a Main Street development done by the same developer. The Main Street is fronted by a whole series of small shops and services and a small civic park that was donated by the developer, dedicated by the developer. And where 175th used to be this horrible street that nobody would want to walk on, it was just traffic all the time with tiny little narrow sidewalks. You know, this is across from Molbach's, if you've been there. Now it's a street where people feel comfortable walking. And it's still got lots of traffic on it. The traffic didn't necessarily go away. It probably got even more intense. But just the values were shifted in favor of having a type of community where it welcomed people to move around on foot as much as around in a car. And the big income tax generators are there, but even they have been given a style and treatment. You can see the typical big boxes back there. The one that everybody else gets is back there. The concrete block box is still there. But attached to it is an element. And I talked to the architect that did this, and he said it was a 1% cost addition. I mean, hardly anything to do this. And they drew from they have an agrarian history there that they drew from. So sort of the target has a kind of farm building look to it that wraps actually all the way around on the sides. And even the backside, which faces the neighborhood, looks pleasant. It isn't just the back wall where the loading docks are. It's got some finesse and character to it. And some of this is, you know, it again, does not have to be expensive. This is just an assembly of wood and concrete block. These are actually not real windows, but backlighted windows. But they have the effect of feeling like windows, real windows. And so it's a pleasant outlook to people that are living nearby. This was a thoughtfully done redevelopment that considered the neighbors in the process. And more and more people are doing that, but not necessarily on their own. They have to be sort of nudged to do that by the communities that they're in. They're not everybody is so enlightened. So they do have to be kind of pushed to do that. Next. I mentioned about policies and plans, and I think you probably have a pretty good working set that probably express a vision very clearly and are inspirational. But one of the things that that we have been using, and this is just a screen capture of this particular computer model, you know, we now have amazing technology that can help us work with communities to plan. And this is a three-dimensional dynamic model that actually you can pick any point in space to look at how this future town center might look. It can be from the living room of the house over here. It can be from the air like this. It can be from the street level. You can rotate it an infinite number of directions. You can fly through it, walk through it, drive through it, fly over it, change the heights, change the densities. This happens to be Auburn. We were working with their council and mayor. and looking at the mix of uses to be clustered around, grouped around their city hall with infill, various forms of infill development. And it's amazing. It's an amazing dynamic tool. We can finally depict things three-dimensionally and play with them. Say, well, what would this be if you added two more stories? What would it be if you took away two stories? Almost do it like that. And then show people what the result is. So, sorry I don't have that dynamic thing with me. You'll have to trust me that it works that way. But it is an amazing, it's an amazing piece of technology that now we're using regularly with every community virtually, that we start out with one of these and start to build it and say, well, what types of things do you want to see happen here and what form might they be acceptable? Let's show that to you. Next. I mentioned new codes. My view is they should be simple, concise, absolutely plain English. They shouldn't require an attorney, an architect, an engineer to interpret them. Anybody should be able to pick them up and understand them within a matter of a few minutes. They need to have a few hard numbers, and it could be all in just one chart. This is a code that we did where almost all of the code was in one page, one chart on one page, and that's all they needed to move ahead with redevelopment. And then to have simulations, I mentioned, using computer models to show people what the outcome of that would be. Next. Design standards, they should be very visual with lots of images, lots of depictions, both photographic and sketch type. They don't have to be that complex. I mean, there's no reason for you to try to read this here, but basically you can read these two pages in probably 3 minutes and get it, what's being talked about. Needs to tell a story. Need to pick out the handful of things, and we try to keep these within a handful of pages. Doesn't have to be a big tome. Just figure out what are the most important things, stick with those, and really nail those, be relentless about those. Try to balance both flexibility and predictability. You don't want total flexibility because then it's kind of chaos. That doesn't work. You don't want total predictability because then it's monotony and uniformity. You don't want that either. So you really want a blend of both. You want standards that allow for some flexibility but with enough predictability to them that people feel comfortable about the results. And then they need to be a dynamic document and be revised from time to time, not kept just unchanged year after year after year. So you need to go back with new generations of buildings, figure out maybe what was missing with that development, what you would like to have seen better, change the guidelines, change the standards to bring them up to date. Next. And then finally, this, I think this is maybe the last one. Again, this idea of making very, very smart public investments. And this is an example, this image, it's an example of finding unusual partners. A library district didn't just build itself a library, a one-story library. They could have done that. They partnered with a housing authority to build below market rate housing for middle income workers to live right in this community. So they put their resources together. These people could have just had a project that you would seen, of, you know, maybe decried as being a project. These people could have just had their single story, single purpose building. They put both together and got far more of a result than they could have if they'd been just on their own. So all these kinds of things, and you're making investments in those, and certainly a facility like this is always a wonderful thing to have. So we're one of the few communities that has something so expansive that I've seen in the region, so you're really lucky to have this kind of place, this kind of facility. But you need to keep working on that list, as I said. You need to keep seeing what's next that you need. What are the next things, and where should they be? They probably shouldn't all be in one location. They should be distributed in different locations. So you get much more access to many more people. So I think pretty sure that's the last one, is it not? Oh, well, that, just the idea of partnering. Private sector, nonprofits, other agencies. This is actually kind of an interesting thing that the city of Tacoma did. They wanted to nurture small businesses is what they were trying to do. So they set up a neighborhood investment program, neighborhood business investment program, and they put a number of architects on call. The city provided I think it was either a $1,000 or $2,000 worth of design services to work with small businesses to just spruce up their storefronts, to do light touches, something that would enhance that business. And so they went through, this had been just an ugly, boring building, and the designers that worked with this merchant came up with this very simple color motif and kind of very wonderful piece of sign that, and just the idea of little flower boxes that flank the door, fairly low-cost stuff. City helped kind of that, as that was, they viewed that as a way of nurturing, helping nurture those small, local, homegrown businesses to help them out. This is not help that big corporations need. They have their own people to do that. This is helping the small business folks. Similarly, if you've seen Fairhaven in the city of Bellingham, that turnaround is astonishing. That was a place that used to be almost nothing going on. There were two or three businesses there. This was a place that now every block has got something going. All the stores are full. Almost all of them, from what I can tell, are local. There's almost no national brands in this place. And there's probably now over 1,000 units of housing built around the edges of the commercial center so that now people can walk into it rather than drive to it. And so you can see a little sign showing up of bicycling, the wider sidewalks, the active storefronts, and they have a very wonderful program to make sure that storefronts are done in the classiest ways possible. They really have instituted, embedded the Main Street program idea into all of their thinking, all of their codes, all of their programs. So they grab hold of any opportunity they can and make sure that it's the best that they can possibly get. And they are seeing dramatic results out of that. So there's a lot of really wonderful local stories. People are doing lots of interesting things now. Again, even local government is rethinking how it can do its job better. And everybody's approaching it a little differently. There's not one model that everybody's repeating over and over again. That's what's interesting to everybody has their own blend of things. And so I'm confident that this community could craft its own unique blend of the things that I'm talking about and get to where it wants to go. So I believe that's probably the last one, isn't it?
No!
Okay, is this the last one? Okay. So anyway, the importance of local financial commitment is that it brings other parties to the table. Private sector basically will not come to a community in any major way until it sees the public sector making key investments. That is one of the main lessons of the last 30 years, that those communities that have made strategic public investments are seeing the corresponding response from the private sector. They're seeing good people come into their community doing good stuff. If you don't make those investments, you're left in the dust. And there are plenty of communities that are being left in the dust. That means perhaps restructuring even how local government operates, how it uses its energy, human capital. That people have been doing that like crazy, making sure they have more effective units that can apply their resources to development. And it opens up lots of opportunities, a lot of which are totally unexpected. I mean, people are now finding really interesting things happen, whether they're public spaces, whether they're gathering spots for people in the community to come to that didn't exist before, whether they're museums, whether they're other cultural facilities. They're happening right and left. People are seeing now. In fact, I submit we're, in this region, we're in sort of a golden era of civic buildings, like this state, this part of the state has not seen ever. That when I added up last, not even counting the stadiums, but just all the other public buildings, schools, city halls, fire stations, community centers, libraries, all of those public goods that everybody enjoys collectively, it's $2 billion worth of investment in this region. That's a huge amount of capital investment. And communities are doing more and more of those kinds of investments. They're seeing more and more results in terms of corresponding private investment. So it really is a very important thing to focus on, of how to use resources of local government effectively to look at the next 30 or 40 years. So those are the messages I have. I like to also get lots of questions, if you care to do that, because often stuff comes out only that way. So I think that is now the last slide. So at this point, I think what we'd like to do is turn it over, you know, or just turn it over to you folks. We'll see if you have any thoughts or questions. Yes.
I don't want to lose this train of thought, but when you were on the slide talking about the computer model, it had on there on the words, know what you want.
Oh, yes.
And know how to say no to what you don't want.
Oh.
And I want you to teach us how to say no.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's that. I'm sorry I missed that. I must have turned away just when those words went on. Yes, you need to know both. You need to establish where you want to go. But in the process of doing that, sometimes you do need to say no and wait for better stuff to happen. And it's happened to community after community. They have shaken in their boots because they're worried that somebody will be upset if they say no to a certain development. But they've said no. And then what happens 3 or 4 years later? Somebody better comes along and does exactly what they wanted to see. So sometimes you do have to say no to certain types of development. There was, I mean, probably the most dramatic instance that I was personally involved with was when Robin and I were in City of Bellevue together. There was a gas station on a key corner, Northeast 8th and Bellevue Way. It was like one of the national brands, Chevron or something, and they came in with this kind of half-baked idea of a little corner store, drive-up mart, you know, quick stop kind of thing that wasn't comporting with anything that the city's vision stated in their plan, nor in fact the codes. But they were just recalcitrant. They just said, this is our national model. We don't do anything else. This is what we're going to do. We'll go away unless you give us a permit. City said, we don't want to see that. That is not our future. You can go away. And they did. 2 years later, they sold the property to Kemper Freeman, and the 22-story building sits now in that place, actually several major buildings sit in that place. You know, many times the tax stream that would have happened from that gas station. And so they just waited, but that's just a very exaggerated tale. That same tale has happened in city after city after city, where sometimes you actually do need to say no. Next, any other questions? Yeah.
Are you familiar with the City of Shoreline's oral corridor project that we embarked and started?
On Aurora.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I just drove it coming up here, and it was terrific. I mean, I think that is a great example. I think I wish you well with that. I think it's just going to get better and better. The pedestrian bridge gateway effect is terrific. Some great. I mean, it's already changed, I think, in good measure, the community image.
In your opinion, do you think the City of Shoreline should continue the visions of that oral corridor project, or should it be lessened or perhaps make it less impact to the local communities? Uh-huh.
Well, I think whenever you design any public works project, you have to take into account the needs of adjacent businesses. But that doesn't mean that just they get to do business as usual, like they've always done it before with, say, a continuous curb cut, with no restriction on that. I think you can impose reasonable limits to get the project to happen. Whether or not the future phases of that happen exactly in that way, don't know if that needs to happen. But I think it's a very smart, good move. And I think in a large measure you should continue it. May morph, it may have some different characteristics, but I don't think you should just water it down to be sort of a weak version of that.
Would you consider that is the city's commitment to the future of Shoreline?
Definitely.
And the visions to encourage the future developments and perhaps other developers to come along and improve the city?
I think so, yeah. Yep. I think that's a very important strategic investment. And community after community has done exactly that thing and gotten dramatic results within a short few years.
Mark, up here.
Regarding the Aurora project, can you imagine that it could be any better?
I have to confess, I have been traveling so much, I have not seen it in the daylight. I only saw it this evening after it was dark. So I didn't look at I was looking at things like the sidewalk. I was trying to see that in the sidewalk realm and just what was going on there. And I confess I wasn't able to really see that. I know Steve was trying to get me out several weeks ago to take a walking tour,
and I just wasn't, it just didn't happen. But I think if it doesn't do the job in terms of the pedestrian environment, it needs to. And what that is in terms of street trees, sidewalk width, certain types of paving, those accommodations, it certainly should. It, for all I know, maybe there are, that's in the plans. I don't know. But it needs to have that value there if it's not. So.
Well, the reason I mentioned that is the one slide you have that showed the place over in Redmond, I think you said it was development, the Target store.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's Woodinville.
It did have several name brands there.
Yep. You need both. Any community needs a mix of both. If you get if you only have the local shops, there's sort of not the dynamic economy of scale that happens with the national brands. If you only have the national brands, it's a boring place. So you need to be able to figure out how to accommodate both. Key relationship is, I think I saw a few of the newer buildings doing this. The key relationship is those buildings need to move close to the street, which is counterintuitive to how we've been doing it in the past several decades, which is to push them away from the street. They need to be not necessarily right at the back of the sidewalk, but very close to it. And there's a time-tested, hundreds of year-old observed relationship between merchandising and the public realm, that if you break that, it's a totally different environment, and we need to reconnect storefronts with the street edge. Yep. So, yeah, that's one thing. And the parking can still be there. It's just off to the back or off to the side, landscaped, screened, all of that. It still can be there, same amount of cars. It's just not out in front. That's the old model. We can't do that anymore. That's the old model. And that model is going away in community after community after community. The parking is going somewhere else. It's not out in front anymore.
Yeah, here's one up here.
Yeah.
Up here. Yep. Using Woodinville as an example, I think, is a good idea because Shoreline can learn a whole lot from Woodinville because we used to live in Woodinville, so I can speak to that area. It's not necessarily unanimous that Woodinville has a viable area there in the area you were discussing, the buildings. As an example, 175th Street, the main street through town, isn't a walking street. It has more cars now and continues to have more cars every day than it ever used to. So when I think, and I believe it was TRW was the company that,
Rainier Fund,
worked PRF. With the city, as you're describing, closely to develop a user-friendly shopping mall. Well, it's something less than user-friendly. It's a series of parking lots connected by, my term is retro industrial buildings. You know the architect, it sounds like. You can tell him that he didn't do a very good job on it. And there is a fair population in Woodinville who believe that same thing. And I haven't been there for a couple of years, but at the time it was being built, it was sold as the next best shopping center you'll ever have. And it turned out to not be that. And there were a lot of rules bent and a lot of allowances to TRW to develop it. And the people in Woodinville didn't really get what they wanted, and they were disappointed.
Yeah, I don't think any place that can be pointed to as being perfect. I mean, everybody
No, and there's no perfect place. Yeah. But as an example, if we're going to, here in Shoreline, if we're going to develop partnerships with developers or the money, we really need to be cautious about what we're getting into.
Yep.
And if we relax the rules
and
the codes, and the whatever else. If we tend to dumb down these codes, then we're going to get exactly that.
Exactly. No, I would agree with you. Yeah. Yeah. Next to you, there's a question.
I don't know if I don't know if it's addressed in what you're trying to say, but what I didn't notice was a whole lot of public, essential public facilities accommodation. Now, the library should be an essential public facility, but that was just about the only one. And, you know, in a place like Shoreline where you do not have massive amounts, what you're looking at is teardowns and opening up areas in order to build city halls and that kind of a community concept that you were talking about. And so one of the things I find that it's sometimes very hard if the city council has all these people, supports, computer programs, et cetera, and then we as citizens step in and we try to add our 2.5 cents worth, and we're not exactly matching into the plan. But I think that we really need to be heard to provide our input, and most of all, we need to establish where we want to have essential public facilities to accommodate the residents of Shoreline.
Yeah, I would agree. The place, however, I think for citizens to intervene effectively is when the policies and codes and regulations are crafted. That's where it's important to interact, and that's what people don't sort of realize. They need to be watching to what those standards are so they're as good as possible. It's very fruitless to try to intervene at the project stage. That's where people go nuts at all parts, all, you know, across the table, across the fence, and that's almost never a productive result, to try to argue at the stage of a project. You have to go back to what the foundational principles and criteria are that are guiding the forms of development. That's where you've got to intervene. And really, it is a huge energy drain to try to deal with something on a project-by-project basis. That is, it's like rolling stone up a hill, the Greek myth or whatever. That's just not fun for anyone. So that's another really good lesson that the number of communities are get engaged in those standards. No, it's a little more abstract. It's not a real building. It's not sort of as meaty as a real building to deal with, but it's a lot more productive in the end result. And the communities that have adopted good, solid, clear, concise, easy to read standards have gotten good results. And that's where you need to intervene. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry.
So I guess this is really kind of a continuation of the previous comments there, because you talked about some good things. Vision. It starts with this kind of overall vision.
Right.
And then you talk about core, community, and that these cores and communities are centered really around pedestrian orientations, taking away the vehicle out of it, which really sort of creates barriers to that. And so one of the things I think that you have an issue with is that you have large geographic areas. So you've got not just, sort of, say, an overall vision for the city of Shoreline, but you've got, within the city of Shoreline, specific areas that you want to try to create cores. So you've got interconnectivity issues. And then you talked about design standards, massing of buildings to make sure that they blend. Particularly since I understand the city is considering height increases, particularly along certain areas, to make it attractive for developers to come in. Understanding, you know, the complexity of developing a project, making it pencil out, but you've got massing issues, design standards. I guess my real question is, how do you get the city council, the mayor involved, the planning department, to establish the broad overall vision and the guidance that accomplishes the broad vision, and then these individual core communities that are pedestrian oriented, that are interconnected, and establishing design standards that have, you know, massing that matches, that doesn't have something out of place. How do you work with the city councils and the planning departments to give them so that they can create the structure so you don't have a huge building that's 120 feet tall, you know, that stands out like a sore thumb, that doesn't mix well in the overall development?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it, you know, you obviously have some mechanisms already that you can work within. Your comprehensive plan, you know, your various sub-elements of that comprehensive plan. But it's a whole series of layers. I mean, I don't know if the city's already pursuing this or not. It may be. But one of the very useful things is to have sub-district planning, kind of neighborhood-level planning, where you carve out an area that is sort of a unit that can be easily walkable. And we, like I said, we usually draw sort of a quarter-mile radius around a center point, and what that center point is can be different. And different means sometimes that's a transit center, sometimes it's a government building, sometimes it's a school, sometimes it's a community center. But to put a sort of area, planning area around that, and then look at what all needs to be in there to make that essentially as much as possible a self-sufficient, self-sustaining place where whole bunches of choices are available, from the commercial end to the institutional end to the healthcare end, to the, you know, all of the services that you might need as a person, as a household. And then you get one or two of those going right, going well. Just really work at, you know, don't try to do six or seven simultaneously. Everybody go crazy trying to do that. Pick one or two to start with. Make those work really well. Get them on their way. And then move on to the next two or three or four. It's just not possible to cover the world simultaneously. You know, there's just not enough energy to go around, not enough resources. So to grab a hold of those areas. And some of them may be okay for more intensive development. I mean, we recently finished a several-year stint of working with a community in Idaho that wanted to see towers, but only in a very small location, very tight location. And anything that was near where people were living in lower density development, we had a transition zone that scaled buildings down. Now, they're still seeing development in those transition zones, but they're like townhouses and row houses, single-family attached units, cluster-type housing that are grouped around courtyards. There's a whole sort of array of choices they're seeing, but they're also seeing towers happen in a couple of two or three spots. And as long as that transition technique is working, people didn't seem to be upset about that, so at least in that community.
I don't want to interrupt the flow here, but I guess I already have. I just wanted to interject that where the vision comes from is from the people of the community, including the people in this room and the people watching at home. They're elected officials, they're planning commission members, they're advisory committees on everything from housing to the environment to neighborhoods. The website of the city and Currents are the two ways that we communicate with the public. That is a way to track the things that you're asking about. And just to follow through on Mark's point here about sub-area plans or special areas around the city, our website will tell you about several of those areas that are underway right now. You mentioned one, I think, made reference to the south end of Aurora, where we're looking at a sub-area plan update there. Planning Commission will be having hearings talking about what's appropriate there. Might not be the same that's appropriate in Ridgecrest, where there's a separate sub-area effort going on as well. Around the City Hall area, that part of Central Shoreline, later on this year or next year, we'll be looking at what might be appropriate there. Again, one size does not fit all. It really takes looking at these sub-areas specifically, creating a vision, and then coming up with the kinds of tools that Mark has described. End of interruption. Back to you, Mark.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, actually, I could use this again. One of the things that I think people have learned painfully over the last 30, 40 years is that zoning by itself doesn't assure any quality. It's a neutral tool. All it does is establish numbers of parking stalls, heights of buildings, heights of fences, setbacks, all that. It's just purely quantitative. There's no way that zoning by itself can assure quality. So you need another set of mechanisms to get the quality part to be there, whether it's design standards, overlay districts, special areas, special design review areas, and all of those tools are being used by other communities. You can use them too. Totally legal. Plenty of case law on that. You can get where you want to go by crafting and tailoring things to make sense for an area. And as Joe said, it is not one size fits all. That is the dilemma with zoning. We've established these districts that then get applied to a map, and it is a swath of stuff that, you know, ends up being undesirable. So we need to be a lot more site-specific, location-specific, and careful about what we do that makes sense for that particular area. And it's probably always going to be somewhat different, depending on what the context is.
Mark, so, could you kind of pick the next two so we can be ready
sure.
for you?
Text the next two? Oh, yeah.
And what should be the next one? Okay. Lenita Wacker, pardon me. I'm a little confused here. Early in your presentation, you said we should simplify the code,
yep,
like 6 pages,
yep,
something like that.
Yep.
Do those codes apply citywide? Because now we're talking about sub-area planning.
No, I'm thinking for a particular area, that's all you would need is a half a dozen. I don't mean the city as a whole. I mean,
okay,
for that particular area.
Okay. And then you were talking about project for project. This follows up on that.
Yep.
The thing is, when you have the 6 pages of policy, which should be well thought out and approved by the Planning Commission and the City Council and the citizens, once that's in place, then the investor or the developer should be able to depend on,
absolutely,
that 6 pages,
yep,
when they walk in the door.
Absolutely.
So that they're not going to have a big fight,
absolutely,
and cost a lot of money.
They should absolutely be able to assure that that is the document that they can rely on.
And
that there is case law on that.
The thing is, we have a city that desires a fulfillment of our vision. I think there's confusion about what our vision is. But the thing is, we want economic development. We want people to come in and invest. And we're sitting scratching our heads after 11 years. Why hasn't it happened? Why aren't people coming in? And I talk to developers, and they say it's a pain in the neck to work. So I think we have a lot of work to get there so that they are able to be confident.
Yep, yep. Well, we just to give you another example, we recently finished working in this small community of Washougal. Does you know where that is? East of Vancouver. They had an area that was languishing for decades. Nobody was coming in doing anything. It was a miserable place. Hardly anything at all. I mean, you'd walk through the main area of town, and there was just nothing going on there. Maybe a Mexican restaurant. That was about it. I mean, it was a good restaurant, but that was about it. So what we did was we threw out their old regulatory structure, which was just this old thing left over from decades past, and gave them this very condensed, concise, very crisp, and clear set of regulations. And it was condensed down to, I think in that case, it was 4 or 5 pages, and then a set of really good inspirational design standards that were clear and easy to read. Even citizens could understand it. It was very evident. Those were said to be the expectations by the city council. That was what everybody agreed on collectively, that that's where they wanted to go. They have, I think they only adopted it 6 months ago, and already they have 5 major mixed-use projects, one of which is already under construction, and 4 others are going through the last stages of the permitting process. I mean, it has almost happened in a breathtaking speed.
Terry, are you?
Steve. She actually spoke to my issues, but I think I have another question for you. And that is, in an environment where the city can only impact developers to a certain point with codes and regulations, et cetera, how do you ensure that the developers are going to follow through? The example you gave in Bellevue, where the Chevron station kind of gave up and moved out, and the next person came in and built, was that what the city wanted, or is that just what the city got, and they're more pleased with that as opposed to the Chevron station being parked there?
Well, the city's vision was expressed in terms of having dense, mixed-use urban development. And so when they didn't see that coming in, they were willing to say, no, that's not good enough. That doesn't comport the other places in the community that will are perfectly fine for that form of development, but not now in this area. So they said no to that. And actually, it was kind of an example in a classroom of, you know, where there's unruly kids. You make an example of one, in a sense. I think that was the only time they actually ever had to say no. Everybody else got with the program. They saw it. Oh, well, if you're willing to, you know, drive somebody out, one person, we'll do the right thing for you. Now we see what you want. You're serious about it. And so that was, I think, the only time they actually ever did reject something. So it was, I mean, it was just a stunning case example made of that they were committed to seeing it go in that particular direction, and something less than that was not going to be acceptable.
Thanks. Sorry to
That's okay.
Speak again here. The gal
no
that just left wanted me to ask a question. So, everybody here knows that I work hard on preserving natural areas, open space, along with development. She wanted to know specifically about tree ordinances, putting in street trees that will survive through drought, mm-hmm. and et cetera, having regulations about that. But I wanted to mention a little more transformative type of development that I worked on at Northgate, where the developer wanted to put in, you know, the big box 30-screen movie theater, and the community had already done the first comprehensive plan in Seattle, Northgate Comprehensive Plan, and they had all kinds of expectations, and the developer came in and said, our way or the highway, and they were going to go ahead. The city was going to let them, it appeared, and some of us said, whoa, no way, you know, you have to do something about that creek that's under your parking lot. And so it took a long time, but they finally got with the program. In effect, the community said no. And the developer, we went through two developers before finally the one came in that said he would do
well,
it
that
right.
Was, how many, that was probably 10 years worth of fighting, wasn't
well,
it?
Well, seven. But, yeah. Well, 10, I mean, ten for some of them.
Far better would it have been to have an initial plan or document that said, This is what we want to see. This is adopted by the city council as policy. The stream will be reopened, daylighted, whatever. That is what we want to see for development.
Right.
And may have only been a few years before development happened. I mean, that is sort of the, I mean, even though the result was happy, the process was horrible.
Painful,
and how many people would want to go through that? You know, I mean, there's too many other things we want to do in life.
Yeah. But on the trees issue, you know, so like including them in and getting a plan for the whole city, you know, that's been a lot of people.
Again, I'm not familiar with all of the skill sets and all of the staffing things that you have here. Every community is different. Even if I knew, I'd probably forget the next day. But you need to have at least if you don't have it on staff, on contract, an urban arborist that knows urban trees, because the urban forest is much different than a pastoral forest. And to have trees that work in urban environments is a much different thing. It's not just a matter of having a committee say, we like tree A, B, and C. None of those trees may work in an urban environment. And the people on the committee may not know that. I mean, there is not just an art, but a science to urban trees. And certain trees will work in urban settings and work very well and last and be sustained. Even in low water periods, I mean there are communities throughout this part of the country that are prideful of all of the street trees they have. They're not failing, they're not dying, they're thriving. They may be occasionally hit, and the tree has to get replaced, but they're managing that urban forest. And it is a question of management and being smart about that management. And certainly protecting green belts and protecting sensitive areas is a big part of that. Because you don't want to just do street trees. You want the whole natural system to be connected and woven together. And there are many communities that now do have tree preservation ordinances. They tend not to apply to so much to single-family development, but to commercial development and multiple family, they tend to apply to those forms of development. But they are seeing the result. I mean, in some cases, the communities have had them in place for 20 or 30 years. And people are still developing. I mean, I have a theory that if you went around this very region that we're in and looked at all of the high-value communities where the property values are the highest, the investment is the greatest, the quality of investment is the best you can get, it's also where you see the tree canopy preserved and enhanced and maintained and nurtured. I think there's a one-to-one relationship. You just, and where you don't see it, you don't. In fact, I was working with a community just up the road here, Linwood, a few years ago, and the city council asked me, well, why are streets just so ugly? They're just ugly everywhere. Just why are they just so ugly? You know, I mean, everybody tells us they're just ugly. So I said, well, you're right. Let me drive around. You're right. There's like no trees anywhere on any of the streets. I said, how could that possibly be? How could a community have been through decades of development, had no trees on the street? How is that possible? There's got to be an explanation for that. And I found out that the public works director said he never wanted to see a street tree on a city street.
And he was there for a couple of decades. One person decided the future of a community, and that cannot be right, where somebody just personally doesn't like something and is in the seat of authority to say no forever to that wonderful addition to a community. So that I can tell you they changed their policy after that.
Mark, we have one more in the middle here.
Yes, could you speak to taxes? Here in the city, most of our tax base is on a residential level, and we have not a very diverse tax base. It's there's some real storefront, no industry. Could you talk about how to diversify that tax base and make it a little more equitable across the board for the homeowners?
Yeah, I'm not the best person to answer that question, but I do know when you look around the region that the communities that have the best balance, that you know, if you have that off balance where one nature of the city is bearing the greatest tax load, that's really not a very nice thing to do. I think you need to have the ability to have to capture, you know, commercial taxes in a substantial way. I mean, and it doesn't necessarily take the entire length of say Aurora to be solidly commercial. I mean, you can group commercial development around certain nodes and really pump it up there and get that kind of economic engine operating around those nodes. And the communities that are the most successful fiscally have a substantial tax base from commercial development. I don't know about it. Industrial, I don't think anymore. Industrial is not that big of a factor anymore. It's really the retail and office parts that generate the biggest return now in terms of the fiscal treasury, I think. And that's likely to continue. I mean, we are declining as an industrial kind of based economy. So it's really the service economy that's generating the greatest proportion of kind of local revenue. So you need to work on that to get that portion of your sort of local treasury to be up and running. So I don't think it is fair to have it the sort of the bulk of the tax burden. I mean, I'm assuming you're correct here, but the bulk of the burden being on on one sector.
Mark, I think we have time for one more question, and maybe it can be someone who hasn't asked a question before, because I know you're going to stay after to talk with some people afterwards too. Is there anybody else that hasn't asked a question before?
Shit, one more question.
This is a follow-up. Since you're an urban planner and the tax base, is there any magic formula proportion-wise as our city is, I believe, about 95% residential? Is there any proportion that we should be aiming at as far as what proportion, 10%, 15%, 30% commercial?
I cannot. There are people out there, though, that you could go to with that question that would look at they would probably look at comparable communities in the West Coast or the Northwest and tell you, kind of report to you what there is. I don't know that there's a absolute right answer to that, but it's probably a range somewhere that if you stayed within a certain range, that's where that was your goal to get there and to stay there in that range, it would probably work. But there are financial analysts that work with local governments and economists that do provide that advice. And if the city doesn't have access to those folks, I mean, they are available in this region. There's some very good ones that I've certainly worked with before, and they can help. Honestly, I have to confess, I don't have that kind of expertise at my fingertips. But there are people that do. Thanks. Good question.
Well, as I said, Mark's going to be sticking around for a bit to talk to you one-on-one if you have some other questions you'd like to ask that way, but can you join me in giving a hand to Mr. Hinshaw? Thanks very much, Mark. Could I have a quick show of hands? How many of you are here because you read about this in Currents? Okay. Any of you catch this on the website? Oh, okay. Trying to figure out why the rest of you are here. I'm glad you're here. Another way, though, to get this. Okay, council meetings, planning commission meetings, I think housing strategies, task force also. But another thing that really helps get the public engaged in these kinds of dialogues, and we have five more of these coming up,
is word of mouth. So please, with your neighbors, your coworkers, other folks in town who you think might be interested in this, let them know. Tonight's event is streaming video on the city's website, and we hopefully have the flyers that you all have picked up for the next one of these events. We're going to have Jean Duvernoy on March 19th at the City Council meeting at 6:30. Jean is with the Cascade Agenda Cities Program. I think the Planning Commission and Park Board already heard this presentation last fall. But the Council is going to be hearing it, and the community also will have a chance to hear what Jean has to say about the 100-year legacy for this region and how cities can be a part of that, creating that legacy. There's some others coming up in April. We have a presentation by speakers on green streets, low-impact development, and high-performance public infrastructure. In May, we have Ron Scher, who is developer of Third Place Books, is going to be talking about what makes communities work and how to develop vibrant community gathering places. So stay tuned. Please stay engaged. If you have any other questions you want to direct to our staff, you can reach us through the website or at City Hall. And likewise, Mark's going to be taking some questions up here. After this, I think, if you want to drift out into the next room here, our Planning Commission member, Robin McClellan, there has a few words to say about what's happening after the speech that I've just concluded. Robin, you're up.
Well, the Planning Commission was delighted to be a part of sort of talking through who was going to be in the speaker series and helping to, and we gave up our night tonight. We're not listening to rezone applications tonight, so we could do this instead. And anyway, as a treat, we thought that we would start off our speaker series with a little reception afterwards, so I'm just up here to invite you to have some punch and a cookie, get a nice sugar high, and then go home and try to get a good night's rest.
Thank you. Thanks for coming, everyone.